All right, if we're ready to go, let me introduce you with pleasure to Phil McLemore. Phil's a wonderful voice that we're just so excited to have in Sunstone. He was a charter member of Sunstone way back, you know, in the mid-70s when they first started publishing and things like that. And his career path took some interesting turns. He has degrees in educational psychology and clinical pastoral education. While he was kind of a student leader at the University of South Florida Institute of Religion, the director got sick, and Phil ended up taking his classes for the rest of the year and did so well that they loved him and decided to hire him right into CES. And so he taught institute for there. He taught institute at the University of Georgia in Athens. He was the director of the institute there. Auburn University for at least a couple of years as a director of institute there. And then Phil became, from there was recruited as an Air Force chaplain. And so filled one of the Mormon slots for chaplains in the Air Force. And he just retired about 8 months ago after a 20-year career as a chaplain in the Air Force. Did all sorts of things. I won't tell too much of the rest of the story because that's going to be part of his presentation right now. But we're excited to have him speak to Sunstone. I'm sure you're gonna find out why here in a second. On a personal level, I knew Phil as during one of his transfers. You know, you get transferred enough in the military, and he was hauling around all of his LDS books for every time. And so finally, one day, he came into Benchmark Books where I was working back in the 90s, and he and I met, and we spent about half a day to go through all the books that he was selling. And hopefully, I wrote you a pretty big check. Pretty good check, but anyway, we kind of became friends during that day and a time or two after that. And then when he moved to Utah, he dropped in on Sunstone, and he and I have been going to lunch every couple of weeks since then. So he's been a neat, great friend for me to reacquaint with, and to now we've had another 14 hours in the car with him too. We're just it's just great. So we love him, and I know you're going to be very interested in this presentation about Mormon mantras. I won't say more. We'll let Phil kind of tell this story from there. It's terrific. Yeah. Thanks, Phil.
Tighten my belt on that one. Well, I'm very pleased to be here, and we did have a lot of fun in the car. And thanks for the very kind lady that showed me where the bathroom was. I was in serious distress there for a moment. I grew up in the Catholic Church. In many ways, I'm a product of Jesuit priests, and I remember my first reflection on Mormons. I was 14 years old. We were in our living room, and a Mormon family lived directly across the street from us. And we just come home from Mass, and I was reading the funny papers, and I looked across the street, and again, this Mormon family, now this we're talking the 60s, and you know, in the 60s, you went to priesthood at one time, and then Sunday school another time, and the sacrament meeting another time, and then, of course, during the week, it was Primary and Relief Society, and so I was just watching this family, whoop, 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 traveling, you know, in and out all day Sunday and in and out all through the week, and just kind of reflecting on it. And I turned to my mother and I said, you know, this is a funny world we live in. Here we are, members of the true church, Catholic Church. We go to Mass for an hour on Sunday. We're going to heaven. These poor Mormons across the street, they're running themselves to death, running back to church 40, 50 times a week, and they're all going to hell. That was my initial reflection on the whole thing. When my mother actually got an argument with the priest over my younger brother, and she stopped going to church. And when she stopped going, I was so bored with Mass and really not much spiritual growth in my life. I stopped going to church too. I was always intrigued by what people believe, the impact that the beliefs had in their life. And was, in a way, just kind of always searching and trying to figure that sort of thing out. Of course, the 60s was an odd time. Looking for some of the gray hair and no hair here. Many of you lived through that. And Eastern stuff began to come on the scene in the 60s. And I looked at it a little bit. There was a girl lived behind me named Lark. She was kind of traditional hippie style, and she was meditating. She invited me over for a meditation one day, and I went over, and you know, music was weird, and the incense was giving me a headache, and then she tried to squish my legs in this lotus position, and oh, my knees were killing me. So I thought, you know, God did not create me to be a Buddhist, that's for sure. So I just wrote the whole Eastern thing off and was looking for, you know, more hardcore concrete religion, which I found at age 19. I joined the church at that time after investigating many churches. I don't think you could name a Protestant church that I haven't been in. The doctrine made more sense to me. The religion of Latter-day Saints seemed to be more integral to their lives. It impacted their decisions and where they lived and how they raised their kids, and it just seemed that's the way religion should be. I began to have spiritual experiences like I had never had before, and I just loved the whole idea of an equality of expectation for spiritual growth. It wasn't about a priest or minister, you know, being the expert and having all the spiritual growth, and then, you know, this person telling you what to do. When I joined the church, the sense was, you know, we all had the same goal of becoming Christ-like and the same responsibility. The church, the gospel, was very stabilizing for me at that age. Didn't have a lot going, didn't have a whole lot of good habits. As you know, most cultures, and all cultures and subcultures, have a center of gravity. Their values, practices, principles create a center that draws. And I got sucked right into the center of Mormon gravity. And it was a very good thing for me. I began to live more responsibly, more maturely, began to make better decisions. And so overall, it was just a tremendous improvement step up for me. A year after I joined the church, I served a mission in Brazil. When I came back, was in the student leadership thing, was brought into Teach Institute and Seminary. My whole life has been religion since then, from, you know, CES to chaplain service. And I've just always read voraciously. I mean, I read every LDS book, magazine that people were publishing or thinking about publishing, from The Encouraging Enzyme to The Dangerous Dialogue and The Sarcastic but Seductive Sunstone. And I'm not channeling Elder Maxwell here, so don't. As I begin to live out my life in the church, my biggest disappointment was really the lack of transformation, spiritual transformation, that I was seeing in the lives of others. The change in my life had been so dramatic in just a year. I thought, man, what am I going to be in 10 years or 15 years? And so I began looking around the church for these sainted beings who had been members of the... Actually, I don't have to explain this. I kept looking for these sainted beings who had been Latter-day Saints for 20, 30, or 40 years, and my expectations were very high and often disappointed. Somewhere along the line, I thought eternal progression meant progression. When I moved shifted into the chaplain service, I had a really great opportunity of mingling now with the spiritual leaders and religious leaders of all different kinds of churches. I worked with them, for them, they worked for me, and got to know these ministers, rabbis, priests, very intimately. And again, I found a similar sort of thing. Some really nice folks, a commitment to spiritual growth, but in my view, not a whole lot of real rebirth, of real transformation. Again, I was disappointed with what I was seeing. Now, you find outstanding spiritual people everywhere, period. But my observation has been, it's not a result of the practice of their religion. It's just that these people have some sort of innate spiritual quality that's developed, and they just happen to be in that religion. That was my observation. And of course, my goal was to try to find out how do you get to that spiritual growth, and I just wasn't finding it in systems. Latter-day Saints, I was biased, but Latter-day Saints seemed to be doing better in my eyes than others that I was experiencing in primarily Protestant and Catholic churches. So that pretty much kept me rooted in the church. As 30 years rolled by, I personally just felt validated by what I was doing, the success of my jobs, church positions, activities. And when you're having periodic spiritual experiences, you think you're okay. You know what I'm saying? Your life's not all spirit, but you have a great spiritual moment, and okay, it's happening. You know, we're connected, and so forth. What I didn't face was the lack of deep spiritual transformation in my own life, similar to the criticism I was laying on other folks. And by the way, as a sidebar, I'm finding that there's not necessarily a relationship between having spiritual experiences and actually going through a spiritual transformation. In any case, as many are, at work and at church, I was a bit of an angel. At home, where the real person tends to be, I could be defensive, selfish, judgmental, impatient. Glad my wife's not here. She has a longer list. And I usually lacked the emotional vulnerability to connect intimately and to love deeply. I often approach these failures in typical Mormon fashion. Goal setting, scripture study, prayer, a little fasting now and then. And I really did work very hard to try to overcome these weaknesses and try to become a Christ-like person. I made a little progress, I would call it pitiful progress, mainly in the area of learning to love my wife the way she deserved, and frankly it took way, way too long. Over the years I went through the predictable crises of those who read widely and think deeply. I had my church doctrine, church history crisis, LDS doctrinal crisis, what I call affectionately the BS crisis. Which is just, you encounter stupid and destructive stuff within the social fabric of the church that just drives you crazy and that shouldn't be a part of Christ-like living. I went through that. But I was always able to, you know, rationalize it and make peace with it and just kind of move on, because that's where I was, and I was trying to do my best. As a chaplain, a lot of LDS folks would come to me. I did primarily marriage counseling, personal counseling, marriage counseling for 20 years. And as I began to work with LDS couples, where you're really dealing with them at gut level, the things that matter the most to them, and that's when I became profoundly aware of the lack of deep spiritual transformation in Latter-day Saints. Lost in the repetition of Mormon cliches, overpowered by unhealthy conditioned perceptions, emotions, and behavior, the gospel just was not working for them at the deepest levels of need. In any case, despite my disappointments there, by August of 2000, I reached what I considered to be the pinnacle of my success. I'd done well in the chaplain service. I felt I'd done well personally. I felt I was growing spiritually. I had theological certainty. I seemed to teach the gospel with impact. I had overcome some serious character flaws. And to my delight and her delight, I think I'd really learned how to love my wife, which was my ultimate goal. There was a morning in Honolulu, Hawaii. I was standing in the Stake Center parking lot. I remember looking up to heaven, and I kind of felt like I had made it. I'd completed the purpose of life. At that point, I really felt like I didn't have any fear of death and was, you know, ready to go. Well, a month later, I was in a very, very different state. It's a long story, but the short version is, in the summer of 99, I injured my neck, upper back, and shoulder quite seriously. the symptoms were not treated well, and they ultimately manifested, this all manifested about a year later, a month after my Mormon nirvanic experience there. I was suddenly just overwhelmed with dizziness, muscle spasms, headaches, unusual pain patterns, anxiety, depression. It was just an ocean of misery. I don't know how else to describe it. I was misdiagnosed, misunderstood, mistreated. Doctors had no clue what was going on with me. And once they see symptoms of anxiety, you know, chaplain, you're stressed out. You know, we got some pills for you, and, you know, don't come see us anymore. Really. And it was a bad time. Well, all of a sudden now, I'm not confident. I am confused. I'm unstable, and I'm fearful. And again, I approach this challenge in typical Mormon fashion. Goal setting, scripture study, prayer, and a cascade of priesthood blessings given by well-meaning individuals. And just desperately, desperately looking for the power of faith. After several months, I was exhausted, unsuccessful, and I just surrendered. I just surrendered to the fact that I was going to be a miserable, pain-ridden, depressed wretch. And a wonderful thing happened at the moment of surrender. Two things serendipitously just appeared in my life. One was a book called Full Catastrophe Living by Jon Kabat-Zinn, if you're familiar with it. He essentially he runs the stress reduction clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, but he took Buddhist principles and molded it into a stress reduction program, and so that's what I started with, and that started me meditating, doing yoga, and some other practices, and it was really helpful as far as getting control of spasms, managing pain with some grace and dignity. Getting out of panic and settling within myself. That was, and actually, during my minutes of meditation, I was practically symptom-free. Once the meditation ended, then everything would start back up. In the back of my mind, I'm saying, gosh, if I can be free for 20 minutes, why can't I be free for 20 hours? That was kind of the goal. The second thing that came to my lap was an audio program by Deepak Chopra. I listened to it and was enthralled. So anything he's read or recorded, I digested. I soon took instruction in his form of mantra meditation and adopted that. And then a whole bunch of things happened. I began to realize that this meditation business and mantra business just wasn't about stress reduction, it was about spiritual growth. And all sorts of things began to happen. If I would read scriptures or pray, there was a depth and a richness there that I hadn't experienced before. And so I began to just combine the whole thing, my scripture study, my prayer, my meditation, yoga, I just made it into all one thing in the morning time. And again, I can't explain this whole thing. All I can tell you is I began to experience a bliss and a peace and a spiritual connection that was worth the pain I was going through. It was worth the pain that drove me to that. And over the course of probably 18 months to 2 years, all of these symptoms faded away. Now, I'm still a mess. I mean, if I pick up a heavy suitcase with my left hand, I'm going to generate tremendous amounts of pain and spasm. Well, you don't do that. But it doesn't afflict me in my normal course. And it's not such a bad deal.
Brother McLemore, can you help us move this Saturday?
Oh, man, I'm so sorry. I got this. I'll pray for you. Can't be there, but I'll pray. You guys pick up that piano. So it's, you know, there's blessings to these things. In April of 2001, I had this amazing experience of an altered state of consciousness. And I thought, wow, I have really progressed in my meditation, man. I am getting into outer space. You know, I'm happening. And so the next day when I went to meditate, I'm meditating on a little Zen bench on my knees, and I just, you know, was waiting for this experience that I had of stepping out into the universe and feeling unbounded and so forth, and, you know, it just didn't happen. I was real bummed, and the next day it didn't happen. I thought, oh my, you know, what am I doing wrong? So now I'm getting all worried and stressed about my meditation. Well, fortunately, for those of you who meditate, realize, you flipped over. I was fortunate to run into Deepak Chopra, and I was explaining my problem. And he taught me just a very, very important lesson. And he said, look, don't get attached to the meditation experience itself or any little cosmic stuff you get along the way of your meditation. He said people get, you know, hung up on altered states of consciousness and energy and feelings and stuff. And he says it's all very fun, but, you know, that's not what it's about. And I said, well, what is it about? And he says it's about spiritual growth unfolding and developing in your day-to-day life. When you see compassion and patience and joy and love unfolding in your day-to-day living, then you know your meditation's effective. I needed that. So I gave up looking for the cosmic, continued my practice regardless of what happened. And then I can remember at about the 3.5-year point, I just became aware that there really had been a change. That defensive, selfish, impatient, judgmental, emotionally closed person was gone. And there was this new guy. All these spiritual qualities that I had been fighting for over 30 years with real and serious intent, without even thinking about them, had just in some way unfolded while my intention was just simply on communing. It was a marvelous thing. This presentation is about spiritual growth, and it's based on my observation and experience in modern-day Mormonism that individual spiritual growth is lagging way behind the practice of our religion and the worship of an organization. Spiritual growth unfolds as we have direct experience and relationship with God, which awakens the divine within us, increases one's ability to make aware, conscious, loving choices, and nurtures unity within self, God, and with others. It's characterized by capacity to love and emotional honesty. Both Western and Eastern spiritual texts refer to this state as awakened. Right? I'm awake. Now let me ask you a question. What percent, I mean, just take the average human population, what percent of human perception, emotion, and behavior consists of conditioned response? As opposed to aware, conscious choice. Let's guess. Okay, we're between 85 and 99. Okay, we don't need to debate this. People that study this in some way, it's a hard thing to study, but people that try to study this are always in the 90s. We are a bundle of conditioned perceptions, emotions, and behaviors, period. Now, if you agree to that, you realize that, you know, the free agency that we hold up so much in the church, what that means is it's severely curtailed and pushed down into, you know, 1%, 5%, 8%, or whatever it is. And that is a serious problem. Now, it happens because of the way our brain works, just the way the brain functions, the economy of effort. It gets something down. It locks it in chemically, and we begin to respond. Our self-talk and inner dialogue, you know, the impact of these repetitive thought patterns, thousands and thousands and thousands of times a day, are very serious in this conditioning process. The negative experiences of our lives tend to have the largest impact as we're developing, because our basic instinct is survival. It's a fear instinct. And so that our conditioning tends to be based on fear, maintaining our survival not only biologically but psychologically and emotionally. And these fear-based responses, of course, it's the opposite of faith, it's the opposite of love, and so it impedes spiritual growth. Our normal conditioned responses tend not to lead us towards spiritual growth. I found this in counseling, primarily marriage counseling. You can get well-intentioned people. They want the best for themselves, the best for their family, the best for their self. They're committed, they're ready to roll, and they start to work on stuff, and what happens? I mean, it's hard. Significant change is hard. Some would say impossible. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult, and most people don't do it, quite frankly. Our spiritual insights, good intents, hopeful commitments are just simply overwhelmed by our conditioning. Both Western and Eastern spiritual texts refer to this state as asleep. You weren't snoring, were you? Woke somebody up with that one. You cannot sleep yourself into spiritual growth. Now, there is positive conditioning. There are good habits. Many of you have some delightful habits, wonderful habits. They make life good and productive and so forth. It's just that they don't necessarily lead to spiritual transformation. And that's what I find with much of our experience within LDS religion. Now let me mention briefly just two other barriers to spiritual growth, because they roll into the mantra concept. Number one is superstition. Superstition's been in all religions for all time. And at the heart of superstition is, I'm going to do something here that gets God to do what I want Him to do, right? Doesn't matter whether you're sacrificing lizards or drinking the magic potion or dancing, you know, under the right star or going to the temple, you know, whatever it is. If you're trying to manipulate God to do what you want in your life, then you're practicing your religion superstitiously. The other is just what I call bad religion, and it's when the ordinances and the practices of a religion become ends in and of themselves rather than supports to real spiritual growth. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Right.
Frankly, Elder Oaks in the October 2000 conference gave an absolutely wonderful talk that I never hear quoted. The challenge to become. You remember that? We don't grow spiritually. We don't become by Christ by just logging hours in meetings. Right? Oh, I went to the temple 50 times this month. That means I'm spiritual. Well, not necessarily. If you're just doing that activity as an end in and of itself. So that's bad religion. Now, as I began to break through my karma, my bad karma, my conditioned behavior that was keeping me from being the person I really wanted to be, I began to be more and more disturbed by what I began to see in Mormon culture. Now, I used a mantra meditation to bring about the spiritual transformation I've experienced. What I was experiencing in Mormon culture were mantras that seemed not to be doing the same thing. They seemed to be, frankly, creating spiritual stagnation. So let's talk about mantra for just a wee bit. This is right out of the dictionary that was on my bookshelf. It lists two definitions. Number one, in Hinduism and Buddhism, a sacred word or formula repeated as an incantation. Well, the truth is, in much of Eastern religious practice, their mantras can be used and are used, connected with astrology, with magic intent, so to speak, trying to manipulate the powers of nature and the gods to bless yourself in some way. But there are traditions within Hinduism and Buddhism where mantras are actually used to assist a person to connect with the divine and to overcome conditioned behavior and for spiritual transformation. And that's the sense in which I want to talk about. The other definition is the one we're more familiar with, any often repeated word, formula, or stock phrase, slogan. Now, you might see where I'm headed here. I really want to, you know, we don't have incantations in Mormonism, really. We have a lot of slogans. And what I really want to do is look at the best of mantra practice, you know, as far as a spiritual impact, and then look at our mantras, which are really formulas and slogans, and see how they match up, and see if we can't have mantras within Mormonism that generate some of the spiritual benefit of mantras as I've experienced them in spiritual transformation. The word itself, from Sanskrit, mantra, it's translated some different ways, but typically it means man is mind, tra, device, the device of the mind. The sense of it is, it's a device of the mind to bring about liberation. So, our thinking patterns have imprisoned us, right? Conditioned behavior. So we need a device, a raft that's going to take us from the prison of this incessant crazy thought and inner dialogue to over to the shore of peace and bliss and freedom, where we can make conscious, aware choices. This is just a repetition of what I'd mentioned. You know, it's a spiritual conduit to instill one-pointed concentration, interrupting the flow of the normal thinking process, to allow our attention to slip into silence beyond body and mind to spirit. And that's what I was experiencing in my meditation practice. Some would say it's to put one into a state of harmony with the divine, or specific qualities of the divine. So people who chant mantras, they're trying to get in tune with the particular quality of the divine. And there are different mantras for different qualities you want to acquire. The belief is the sound is putting you in harmony with that characteristic or quality. This is actually a quote from a book by David Frawley, who's a Vedic scholar. It's from the book Yoga and Ayurveda. But he says, used in meditation, it can clear out negative aspects of our consciousness and harmful subconscious habits and impulses, as well as to help promote our highest impulses. And again, it's usually recommended mantras be used silently in meditation, vocally in chanting. Chanting Sanskrit mantras is very popular right now. You can go into the New Age shelf and get Krishna Das or some of these other guys and put it in your CD and chant Vedic mantras as you're driving down the road and just have a good old time. I have a grandson that just loves this particular mantra, and you turn it on, he just starts moving and dancing, and he's into it. Oh! That was bad news. All right, let's get going. Yeah, fight for some minutes for me. Thank you. All right. I divided mantras into categories. I'm not very creative in my category, so I got good, okay, and bad. I'm not much with literature. Now, the same mantra, the same phrase, could be used in different ways, right? Okay. So, a good mantra is going to be one that helps awaken to the higher self, entrain with the divine, create space for conscious and inspired decision-making, promote unity within self. An okay mantra, and these are okay. I mean, sometimes you're in crisis, you're not doing well spiritually, you just need to hold on and not do something stupid, right? You just need to hold ground. So, you know, if you've got something that's going to help you hold on, that's going to provide you comfort, and of course mantras are good for organizations, they keep us all unified and together, I think those are okay. Bad mantras reflect superstition or bad religion, excuse, tolerate, or cover ungodly behavior, oppress, or take advantage of others. Now, the whole concept of a mantra is repetition. And theoretically, in Mormonism, we have a problem with repetition, right? We don't like Catholic prayers and Lutherans because they just repeat their stuff. They just repeat their stuff.
We have some.
I mean, is there any, when a Mormon gets ready to pray at a particular event, is there any, I mean, how often do you hear something that's different? I mean, we really have repetitive prayers. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with repetition as long as it's not thought terminating. See, mantra repetition is designed to be soul expanding. It's vain repetition that's mind numbing. The scripture has a problem with vain repetition, not repetition. Vain repetition is mind numbing, part of conditioning, doesn't allow for free thought. Okay. Repetition can enlarge or shrink your space. Now I want to talk to you about space for a minute, because this is an important concept for me. What I began to notice as part of my, as part of my transformation, as things would come up in my family, what I began to notice is when I would begin to react in my, you know, conditioned way, there was no more time. I mean, a second wasn't any longer. But somehow there was this space in my head where I could see what was going on, get a sense for what was happening, step back, and make a decision that was more in harmony with Spirit. When my son was 16, he went to 3 different high schools because of military moves. He was in high school number 2. We'd just taken him away from his friends, and we were in Washington, D.C. And he came home one day, and I was sitting at the computer typing. My wife's in the kitchen, and he was in a foul mood, and my wife asked him to do something, and he smarted off to her like I have never heard. This kid is an angel. This kid's a saint. And so when he smarted off the way he did, it enraged me. So, you know, within 2 seconds, I was in his face, and I had the dad playbook on page 46, and he's getting the lecture, right? Don't ever speak to your mother this way in this house ever again. Blah, 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 blah. Complete conditioning. Now the interesting thing is, and this is before my meditation time, I was trying to help couples in marriage counseling deal with anger and manage anger. And what I was trying to teach people was, in most cases, anger is an expression of fear or pain. But people don't like to be vulnerable and express their fear or pain, especially when they're not getting along with you. So they tend to be prickly. Well, when somebody's prickly and putting their finger in your eye, you know, you don't normally hug him and kiss him and, you know, understanding and so forth. You're reacting to the anger. But there's really pain there, and there's really fear there. Well, if you saw the person as fearful and in pain, you wouldn't be yelling at him and being in their face. You'd be nurturing and understanding. You're with me, right? Okay. Well, to remember to tell couples in counseling to impress on them this issue about anger, I was repeating to myself every day, day after day, anger is a sign of fear and pain. I was just saying this in my head all the time, so I would remember to say it in counseling, okay? It was my mantra, unaware. So anyway, here I am now in my son's face. I'm used to him being a little boy who would cower when daddy got mad. He's now 16. We're the same weight, and he's looking at me eyeball to eyeball. And I saw the thought move across his eyes. I think I can take him. Yeah, that's what he was thinking. And then I noticed my right hand balled up into a fist. His right hand balled up into a fist, and I thought, oh my, we're going to beat each other to death in our living room. And then when this is over with, my wife's going to beat me to death because I'm the adult here, right? It was a terrifying moment that, frankly, could have been disastrous in so many different ways. Somehow, in the middle of that, this space opened up because of the mantra. And I looked at him and I said, wow, for you to be acting this way, you must have been hurt or you're afraid of something. He just staggered back 2 or 3 steps, sat down in a chair, leaned over, and started weeping. Well, now it's easy to do the right thing, right? Get in the first punch. Vulnerable. All right. You know, he started crying and my heart just melted. So I'm down next to him. I got my arm around him. Holy cow, man, what is going on? Tell me, tell me. So he shares the story and, you know, I get it and I'm sorry. And we talk about what we can do. And it was just an amazing bonding moment between us that has never passed. Never passed. Now, that could have gone either way. That's the power of space. Do you see what I'm saying? That's the power of mantra. That's the power of space. Overcoming conditioned behavior to have an awareness of the right thing to do that's in harmony with the Spirit and the will of God, and then to be able to do it under the stress of crisis. That's the power of this. Okay. And it's actually a marvelous example of agency. Mormon mantras. We've heard one, thank you. There are many. Number one on the hit parade.
Oh yeah, but the church is true.
I know the church is true. It comes in variants. When the but is put in front of it, that means trouble. I know the church is true. Now, where does that fit in our categories? See, is it... Yeah, it could be used in any of those three categories, the good, the bad, or the okay. How it's used normally, you're going to have to judge. All I can say is I don't see it creating much higher awareness. It seems to be a thought-stopping cliche. It's like I'm saved. It's like the Protestant, I'm saved! Made it. Okay, I have a testimony. I know the church is true. When the but gets put in front of it is when it drops down to the bad category. I had a great mission. Not everybody in my mission did, because we had a horrible mission. I had a mission president who wanted to be the number one baptizing mission in the world. He had a system set up of coercion and oppression that was just scandalous. We had a core of thugs that roamed around at, well, I know because I was one of the companions to him. We roamed around at 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. We dragged zone leaders out of their beds, threatened to kick their butts if they didn't get so many first discussions, and threw them out on the street at 2 in the morning to teach discussions to all-night gas station guys until they met their goal. Now, sidebar, I rebelled against the system, got broken to junior companion and sent out to a little city called Ponta Grossa where nobody could find me. And I had a great experience out there. Somehow I was born with the Lowell, I call it the Lowell Bunyan mantra because it comes out of one of his books, in my heart. And that mantra is, I'm not bound to accept or to do anything that is contrary to the character and attributes manifested in Jesus. I don't care where it comes from. You know, I had an apostle say to me, you follow your mission president, you do everything he says, and you obey him because, mantra, obedience is the first law of heaven. Well, I didn't do it, and I had a great mission. And later, as I talked with some of the missionaries who had experienced that, the expression that came back was, but the church is true anyway. See, what bothers me about that is, rather than deal with what's in front of us that's really poor behavior, if not destructive, somewhere between 50 and 70% of the missionaries in my mission went inactive when they went home. That is incredibly destructive because of the way things were done there. Bad mantra. You see what I'm saying? That same thing can be used, at least in the okay category. I was doing some counseling with an LDS couple. The husband was grossly abusive. grossly abusive. I'm recommending that this woman leave him, find a safe place to go. And she says to me, oh my, mantra, he has a testimony. I'm sure it hurts less when he hits you because he has a testimony. Is that what you're trying to tell me? You see the problem with this? But he has a testimony. Okay. You know, when we link these phrases with things that do not reflect spiritual growth, then they're a serious problem. Another couple. Serious financial problems. I'm telling them what they need to do to get their marriage straightened out. One of them's not spending money. And there were some other issues we're working with. They listen to General Conference, good thing to do. They hear one of the brethren say, if you go to the temple, you'll have a good marriage. So they decide to go to the temple. Well, that sounds right. Okay, but they don't live in Utah, they live in Mississippi. And the nearest temple's in Washington, D.C. So they spend $600, make a temple trip, have a good experience, come back, week later, where are they? Yeah, $600 more in debt, more stress, more pressure, more fighting. They're in a worse spot than before they left. That's an example of superstition and bad religion and mantra all in one package. You see what I'm saying? Okay. Here's a great one. Early in our marriage, I used this one. Early in my marriage, when we were very, very poor, we had to decide whether to buy one or two things of something. My wife says we should get two. I said, we've only got money for one. Bup, 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 debate, debate, debate. I pulled out the classic one, right?
I hold the priesthood.
So I get the final word. Well, she said, all right, priesthood. We bought one instead of two. A month later, we obviously needed two, had no opportunity to buy number two. I was wrong. I mean, I was just wrong. And I said to her at that point, you'll never hear that phrase again. I want to be right better, more than I want to be
right.
You know what I'm saying? And we're going to find a way to make these decisions together as partners. I was in a Sunday school class, a gospel doctrine class, in a place in Utah several months ago, and there was a sister sitting behind me who was very troubled by a report that her sister had given her from a state conference in Salt Lake. And what had happened was because there had been, a case of child abuse within the state, and people were concerned about it. So in state conference, the state president says to the the group there, to the stake, that men should no longer be changing the diapers of their daughters. I'm not making this stuff up. I mean, we do this to ourselves. Okay. Well, what's really interesting is the bishop, there was a good bishop in this ward. He's sitting in gospel doctrine class. The gospel doctrine teacher was completely frustrated, didn't know where to go with this. So the bishop now stands up to, you know, save the day, and he comes up front to, you know, to save things. And what does he say?
Well, you know, what's revelation in one stake isn't necessarily revelation in another stake.
And a very nice brother in the front rose up, raised his hands, and he said, Bishop, I'd like that to be a revelation in our ward. He had four young children. Yeah, I turned to the lady behind me and I said, ma'am, I'm sure he meant well. It was just a dumb comment, and he probably thought better about it later. She goes, oh yeah, that makes sense. Now, what's the bishop trying to do? You see, there is a need to sustain the brethren and to make, no matter what is said, okay in some way. And when it's not okay, it's not okay. And, you know, the simple truth really pacified the whole situation. Well, we're running out of time here. you're used to many of these mantras. Higher ecclesiastical position means greater inspiration, right?
Sure.
One last story here, and then we'll talk about some good mantras if possible, where Dan grabs me. I got a hand up. I'm home teaching a lady, abusive husband. As I'm home teaching her, I realize, you're in danger, ma'am. You need to pack your bag, get your baby, get out of here. Do you have a place to go? We set it up. I said, look, Sunday, I'll make an appointment with the bishop. You and I'll go in together. We'll work this out. But get out of this house. Do you agree with me? Yes, I agree with you. Will you do this? Yes, I'll do this. So off I go. She's packing her bag. She's feeling a little nervous. What does she do? She calls the bishop. Hi, Bishop. Brother McLemore was just here home teaching. He's told me to pack my bag, leave the house, blah, blah, blah. The bishop says, well, gee, sister, so-and-so, that's a pretty dramatic step. Why don't you just stay in your house and come see me on Sunday? How about that? She goes, okay, well, I'll think about it. So what? Now, what's the thought process? Home teacher, bishop. Home teacher, bishop. Bishop wins, right? Higher position, more authority, more inspiration. She stays in the house. You know the rest of the story. Husband comes home with a gun, threatens the baby, rapes her, beats her into 14 surgeries, and destroys her face. Okay. Now, that angers me. That's bad mantra. Do you see what I'm saying? It doesn't connect us with good stuff. Set in on a bummer story. What are some good mantras? I have a handout. I went through the scriptures just casually. I pulled out some things that could be used as mantras to accomplish these things here. To awaken the higher self. To entrain with the vine. To create space. To promote unity. Let me share just one or two. You heard my Lowell Benjamin. John 13:34 is absolutely glorious. For some reason, we always quote, love your neighbor as yourself, right? Well, what good is that if you're not a very good lover and you're not doing too well with yourself? That's not very helpful. John 13:34 is wonderful. A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as
I have loved you.
That is a mantra. Okay? How can I love this person as Jesus was loved them? What does that do? Do you see the space? Can you feel the space that opens? Wow, how would Jesus love this person? What does it mean to love like Jesus? See, it opens all this space. It makes all these good connections to empower you to use your agency. I'm working as a hospice chaplain now, and I was visiting a man who's a Catholic theologian. He actually died on Thursday. And before he died, he shared his mantra with me. And I put it on the bottom there. It's one of my four favorites, non-Sanskrit ones. I use Sanskrit and English, but... he said to me, you know, I hear all this talk about what people are going to do for God today. You know, what did you do for God? What are you going to look what God did for you? What are you going to do for Him? He says, I get so sick of hearing that. First of all, God can do what He wants. He doesn't need our help. And when we do stuff for God, we're usually doing it for ourselves to make us feel better. He says, here's what I say. What can I do with God today? You feel the difference? What can I do with God today? I mean, that is such a powerful phrase. Imagine if you repeated that in your head 500 or 600 times a day. The impact. There is a.
What can I with God today?
Oh,
to do.
No, it's what can I do with God today? And, you know, to make that work, you've got to have a sense for what is God doing? And how do I connect with what God is creating and wanting to create? And how, you know, can I be a part of that? And again, you get a sense for the space, the connection with the divine, the empowerment to do your best with others, to bring out the best that's within you. Those are the kinds of mantras we need within Mormonism, not these thought-terminating things that make us feel good. or that make things right. We need things that are going to be expansive, that are going to connect, that are going to bring unity, and that are going to allow us to unfold within us the divine qualities that are inherently there. Okay, thank you so much.